weekend, I guess. We seem to be thin, even for our class. It's a shame. We're sort of getting into the really fun stuff now. So in terms of class stuff, I am about to post your writing assignment for next week and recitation for this week. The hands-on stuff is a little bit hard to do for cosmology, so I actually picked out some interesting video quotes alike, where some of my friends are very good at that, and let them talk to you about some of these concepts. Okay, that's a little bit better. I'm going to see how the front projector works. We didn't try it. So we'll see what happens. At any rate, let me play for just a second, see if I can get the aspect ratio better. Not really. Alright, so we started to talk a bit about cosmology, and I wanted to apologize first about the aspect ratio a little bit. It turns out that, that's really annoying. I was hoping it wouldn't be quite that bad. It turns out that a lot of what I want to talk about, I have figures and stuff, so I thought I'd go ahead and take advantage of old slides, but unfortunately I think I used a different aspect ratio, or was using a computer with a different aspect ratio when I made these or something. So they seem a little bit odd, but hopefully they'll make sense anyway. We've talked a little bit about sort of the historical view of man's place in the cosmos for a while, and we didn't do a lot with the history, but what I wanted to do is spend a good bit of time trying to paint sort of our current view of cosmology today and maybe Wednesday. So in order to have a sense of how things work, we always have to remember that the speed of light is finite, so that as we look at objects that are further and further away, we're literally looking at things that happen further and further back in time. So in a sense, telescopes are very real time machines. And so if you go and you do this, the scales are really quite large. Nearest star other than the sun is about 4.5 light years away. I think in the last recitation I asked you to calculate how long it would take you to jog a light year. What'd you get? I haven't actually done that calculation. It must have been a sort of a big number.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. Hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying to somehow to get an idea of how big a light year is. I mean, it's really big. So, I don't know. The sun is 93 million miles away, and it takes like 8 minutes to go that far. So, the light year is a tremendous distance. And it takes like 4.5 years to reach us from the nearest star. And then, galaxies are almost 100,000 light years across. Of course, they vary wildly in size and everything, so these are just very rough numbers. It's about 100 million light years to the nearest galaxy. 100 million light years. I mean, imagine. It's crazy. So galactic clusters are millions of light years across. So the structures that make up our universe are just mind-bogglingly large. So, in a sense, it's very, very, it's sort of sad, because if you calculate, for example, even the energy it would take to try to reach the nearest star, if you didn't worry about the fact that you have to live a long time and that kind of stuff, or build the ship to do it, energetically, it's actually sort of crazy. So it's a shame in some ways. But as you look further and further back, you actually are looking at processes that happen very, very early in time. And so much of what we're going to talk about today actually is observation of light that was emitted about 13.4-ish billion years ago. The number actually changes as people refine the age of the universe. But so we're going to talk a whole lot about light that was emitted to us as long ago as one can look. Before that time, the universe actually was opaque to light. So even no matter how powerful the telescope is, in principle, you can't see any further back than that, in at least using light. So the birth of the cosmology that we really deal with comes from Edwin Hubble, largely. Vesta Slipher had looked at the speed of various galaxies, though he didn't know at the time. What we knew was there were lots of fuzzy spots, and some of these fuzzy spots, we know now, are literally gas clouds surrounding stars or stars being born or whatever in our galaxy, and they're fairly close. And some of them are actually islands of stars that are much, much further away, which we call galaxies. And at the time, Vesta Slipher was looking at spectral lines in these objects. And what he found was that they were moving away from us, the ones he observed. So how do you know that? The way that you know that is if we look at the spectra of elements here on Earth. So when I had the gas lamps up here, we had the helium and the hydrogen and the neon, etc. And you had gratings. And what the gratings do was they basically act like super prisms, in a sense, taking the light and just splitting the colors up. And what you saw was that very particular colors, you got a bright and so that corresponds to that, for that particular atom, to the frequency of the light. And remember, E equals H nu, so that also corresponds to the energy of light, which is the difference between two energy levels for a transition of electron from a higher energy level to a lower energy level. And because those levels are all different, depending on how many protons you have in the nucleus, due to quantum mechanics, this pattern of lines is different for every atom. But we can look at them, and when we look at them on Earth, the pattern of lines we see here, that is, which frequencies I get colors, is the same here as it is in China. Okay, so that's a given, and we understand it. And what you can find is if you are looking at an object where that light is, the source of the light is moving away from you or toward you, then you'll find that the color of the light is shifted. It's called a red shift or a blue shift. And the best way to look at that, if I didn't kill it, yeah. So if I have an object, this is really for the Doppler effect. So you can imagine that I have an object emitting sound, and the sound's a wave. And so it's really nothing more than, think of it as a drum membrane that's just going back and forth. So as it pushes this way, you'll get a pressure, you'll get high pressure, which is, as you call, for sound waves, you'll get a longitudinal wave basically propagating. So you can imagine that those white lines coming off of the source are regions of high pressure being emitted. And the pitch of the sound that you hear is determined by the frequency with which these peaks hit your ear. So if you get more of them per second, you hear it as a higher pitch. If you get fewer of them per second, you hear it as a lower pitch. So if, for example, your ear is over here and this object is moving toward you, because the speed of propagation of the wave is fixed, and in the time that one wave front goes out, the object has moved in a little bit, it means that as it moves towards you, the distance between those wave crests will be shortened, and that means the apparent frequency you hear should be higher. So as I allow the object to now move toward, say, somebody's ear over here, note that now the distance between these wave crests is shortened greatly. So somebody over here is going to hear a higher pitch. Somebody over here is going to hear a lower pitch. So that's known as the Doppler shift for sound. If the object itself moves faster than the speed of the wave in the medium, then what you see is a shock wave. As it goes farther than the wave has progressed, and you end up with this bow wave. You actually see it if you're in a boat. If you've ever noticed, the boat moves faster than the speed of water waves in the lake. And so you'll see this big bow wave coming out of it. So that's literally a shock wave in the water. So you'll note that it's fairly intense because you have all of these wave fronts basically adding together at the front. And so if you actually ever hear a plane go greater than the speed of sound, and when that wave front hits you, it's known as a sonic boom. It's very loud. Yeah.
So is there a set velocity that the waves have in water?
Yeah. For a given temperature, density of the water, well, generally, the water, you know, it might vary with the purity and stuff of the water a little bit too. Yeah. Yeah. If you were on a lake full of honey, you would find the waves traveling much slower, for example. So when we looked at streams, remember the light stream, the wave propagated much faster, because what happens is when this part of the stream goes up, it has to pull this part up. If this part is very easy to move, so it's not viscous if it's a fluid, or if it's light for a stream, it's easy to move. So F equals ma, it'll accelerate a lot for the given force. If this is very heavy or very viscous, then it's going to move much more slowly, so the wave shape will travel more slowly.
So, yeah. Which part of this would be the shock wave?
The shock wave would basically be this cone front that's going out.
Okay, all of it?
Or yeah. Okay. I mean, that's just what we call a shock wave. Occasionally you'll see pictures where they have a very high-speed camera and they're taking pictures of some really funky things happening very fast, and some pictures of bullets or airplanes moving at supersonic velocities. And if you look at this picture, you actually see evidence of the shock wave. You know, these are very cool. There is also such a thing as an optical shock wave that you get when a particle goes through a material faster than the speed of light, and that's something known as Cherenkov radiation. And in fact, we use that to detect particles. So if I know its momentum, which I can get from how it curves in the magnetic field, and I measure the angle of its shock wave, I can determine how fast it goes. Momentum is mass times velocity, so I can use that to determine the mass of the particle. So, and big particle physics experiments like LHC and other places, they can use it to identify different types of particles and their mass. It's just sort of a cool thing. At any rate, the reason I bring this up, this really, it's true for all waves. So light is a wave, remember? So what that means is that if light of a certain frequency is emitted by an object that is moving toward you, then you will see the wave fronts coming faster, and you will see the light as being bluer, as higher frequency than it is if the source is not moving. If it is moving away from you, it will seem red because there will be a larger distance between the wavefronts as they hit you. So the calculation for sound and for the light is a little different. For light, you're having to take into account relativity, but it basically works. So what you need is something that tells you what the frequency is at the star where it's emitted, or the galaxy, or whatever it is. And that we get from the patterns of the light emitted by elements. So the different elements give you very particular patterns of spectral lines, and you can identify those patterns. And then you look to see at what frequency those patterns happen to sit. If the star is not moving with respect to you, then you will see the colors where each of those spectral lines happens to be for that pattern of light emitted by that element. You will see those colors lie exactly where they lie at Earth. If you have the material at rest with you in respect to lab. And then if the object is moving with respect to you, you'll see them shifted. So if I were to plot the frequency, for example, and this is the spectrum of some element that I can identify at Earth, and I then look at the light coming from a star, and I identify the correct pattern of lines, but I see they're shifted a little bit in color. Okay, same pattern, but now shifted a little bit. In this case, they've shifted a little bit toward the blue, and that tells you that the object where that light is being emitted is, with respect to you, is moving toward you. Now, maybe you're moving toward the object, or it's moving toward you, but you know, you get this shift. The amount of the shift determines how fast the object is going. So you can literally look at spectral lines from galaxies and we can tell their speed with respect to us. And so this is what Slipher did. And he looked at relatively nearby galaxies because he could, and he had the equipment to do that. And he discovered they're basically all moving away from us, which was sort of an odd result. So Edwin Hubble had been spending time studying a type of star called the Cepheid variable, which goes through cyclic changes in its brightness, and it turns out that the absolute level of brightness that it has is correlated to the period with which the brightness goes up and down. The thing is, if you want to determine the distance to an object, what you'd like to use is something we call a standard candle. So that is, if I have a candle and I know exactly how bright it is, I know how much energy per square meter per second it kicks out, something that measures its brightness. Because that energy goes out as a sphere, it drops off as 1 over the distance squared. And you know this, basically. If I took a candle and it's so close to you and I doubled the distance, you would see it as 4 times dimmer. So you can literally, if you know the brightness of the object, you can determine how far away that object is. But there are complications, because if you're talking about things on a cosmic scale, you have to worry about whether you have interstellar dust between you and the object. I mean, that's a problem. Right, so there are lots of complications that can come into play. That is, you really don't have control over the environment between you and that object. So the fabulous thing about Cepheid variables, so that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is you can't just see a candle from very far away, so you really have to have something quite bright. The nice thing about these Cepheid variable stars is, independent of the actual distance, if you can resolve the star and you can watch it with time, you can see it get brighter and dimmer. And then you can measure the frequency with which that's happening. And by studying Cepheid variables closer to us and using other techniques to determine the distance to them, you can come up with the relationship between the period and the brightness of the star. So to get some idea, I mean, you sort of have to build up the whole standard candle idea. So the first thing you have to do is to use techniques that you cleanly understand in order to understand the stock. And one way of doing that is something called parallax. So this is going to look a bit ridiculous, but if you all do it, it's okay. What I'd like you to do is take a finger here and put it sort of close to your eye. Sort of stare off at something distant, then put another finger out here, okay? And then I want you to move your eye back and forth and tell me what you notice in terms of how your two fingers are moving with respect to the far distant wall. One moves a lot more. The closer the object is to you, as you go back and forth, the more it moves against that far distant background. And boy, are you lucky. You have no idea, because I was going to make you guys calculate something like this on Wednesday in recitation, because you can do it. But I decided it was a bit of a pain, and after a while it might... after enough of geometry, you might decide it wasn't much fun. But you can imagine, you can take simple geometry, and you can actually figure out what the relative distances are of these stars. So, astronomers do this to determine the distances to the nearest stars. If you assume that the far distant stellar background is very, very far away, and you make an observation of a nearby star when, you know, in the spring, and another one in the fall, as the Earth has moved back and forth quite a distance, right, 2 times 93 million miles roughly, then when you look at the nearby star, you'll see it has changed its position relative to the far away star. And from that, you can actually use geometry and calculate how far away that star is. So when I tell you the nearest star is 4.5 light years, we actually know that. And we know it from basic geometry. And it doesn't really matter or depend on whether we have gas clouds between us and that star. So for nearby stars, we have geometrical ways of understanding how far away they are. You do that to enough Cepheid variable stars in your neighborhood, you then learn that you can correlate the absolute brightness of that star with the period of the change in its luminosity. So once you understand that type of star and how its absolute brightness depends on the period, then you can do what Hubble did, which is basically you have a powerful telescope and you look at Cepheid variable stars in galaxies. Because for the nearby galaxies, we actually can resolve stars. And you can then plot, you can observe the Cepheid variables, and by their period, you know how absolutely bright they are, and you measure how bright they are apparently. And if you know how bright it is due to its period, and then you know how bright it is that you see, you can calculate the distance. So this is basically what he did. And he correlated his distance measurements to the velocity measurements that Slipher had, and he found that they were absolutely, they're linearly correlated. And I meant to pull up the original data. This is actually later data. This is, I didn't put the reference here. This is more recent. This is like early 90s or something. And you can see the correlation is quite dramatic. The early data, it isn't anywhere near so dramatic, actually. It's one of those things where you look at it and you go, really? How did you get that out of the data? At any rate, this particular correlation then is what leads to people saying we live in the expanding universe. And to understand that, I think you did a little bit with last recitation, looking at how the velocity of recession depends on how far away you are in something where you have the space expanding. But the easiest analogy I have for it is you imagine that you have raisin bread dough, and you'll have a distance between each of the raisins and the raisin bread dough. And as the bread dough rises, if you were to calculate the velocity of recession of one raisin with respect to another, you can imagine raisins that are fairly close to one another certainly move apart, but raisins that are very far apart from one another move apart much faster because the distance between them, the distance between them grows much faster because you have all that bread dough expanding in between them. So the more bread dough you have between the two objects, the faster they're going to recede. So the data basically tells you that the space in our universe is expanding. You okay with that? All right, so just to remind you of a couple of things, because we talk a lot about sort of general relativity, and we will talk a bit about things like the curvature of the space. And remember, we've talked a little bit about Einstein's general theory of relativity, and one of the things that he has, and basically the thing that underlies it, is called the equivalence principle, where you say that an accelerated reference frame is equivalent to a gravitational field. So, just to remind you a little bit of that, so what we're saying is if you're in an elevator, or if you're in a box on Earth, you really can't tell the difference between that and being on a box in a rocket ship that's accelerating at 1G. That's what the equivalence principle says. You cannot tell the difference. And then if you look at different physical processes using those two situations, you shouldn't be able to distinguish them. And so if we imagine that you have something that sends out a pulse of light and you're on the rocket ship, then you know what to expect. Since light travels at a finite speed, as it leaves your laser, the rocket ship is accelerating up around it. So literally that pulse of light will look as if it travels in a curved line. And that actually intuitively should make sense to you given that you're in this accelerating rocket ship. Now comes in Einstein's equivalence principle, which says, well, you can't tell the difference between that and the gravitational field. So suddenly you are saying if you are in a gravitational field, light travels in a curve. And this is sort of the foundation of why people talk about gravity being interpreted as something that bends space-time, because you say light moves in a straight line. What you mean by that is that it moves in the shortest distance between two points, but because of the equivalence principle, you've just said that that's a curved line. So the whole theory of general relativity is built in something called differential geometry, where you literally think of energy and gravity, mass, as something which curves the space-time, and you build the theory on that. And so you think of space and time as a fabric, and so that's where a lot of the language comes in. That language is going to sneak in as we talk a bit about cosmology in different ways. And, you know, it works. It appears in numerous ways to predict and explain things that Newton's law of gravity actually gets wrong. And so in particular, one thing you can imagine is if during a solar eclipse, for light that grazes, comes close to the sun, it has to take a path right by the sun. If in fact the sun is curving the space, then the apparent position of that star relative to the far background should change, and in fact, people do see that. If you do the same trick that we were talking about for moving galaxies, but you now look at it in the gravitational field, it turns out that you also expect to see light's frequency change depending on whether it's going up or down in the gravitational field. The orbit of Mercury sort of precesses so that it moves like this, and sort of the position closest to the sun actually precesses as you go around the sun, and general relativity gets that right. And then there's the prediction that since you think of space-time as a fabric, if you have some event cosmologically that causes a big shift in mass, so like colliding stars or something crazy like that, you would actually expect to see reverberations in the fabric of space-time, which are called gravitational waves. We've not yet seen those, but we have seen a few things that are highly, how do I say it, they are consequences of them. So one of the reasons we haven't seen them is because the amplitude is very small. And I forgot to do this when we were talking about... Doppler shift. But now, okay, so you can hear a sound, right? So now you can be able to hear the Doppler shift, right? As it's coming toward you, you get the higher pitch, and it goes away from you, it's lower. But it never changes. Okay? Alright, so how are we doing? Alright. Okay, so
far to leave.
If you have experimental evidence that shows space is expanding and you go back in time, then clearly space, as you go back in time, space is contracting in a sense. Okay? And it should be getting hotter and denser and hotter and denser and everything. And so you can take something the size of what we see as our universe and go back in time, and you basically get to a point at about 13.8 billion years ago, 13.7 billion years ago. I think the better number these days is 13.8, but, you know, a few hundred here, a few hundred there. After a while, we have real money. I mean, I don't know whether we care in this class, but if you go back in time, you basically reach a point where you have infinite density, infinite energy density, and so something happened to start the expansion, and we just call it the Big Bang. It's a little bit odd because there was nothing to bang into. It's not an explosion. Space itself is expanding, so it's a very different thing. The Big Bang is a misnomer that was promulgated by somebody who actually thought the whole idea was ridiculous. So it was a very, well, they believe in the Big Bang and not some radio broadcast, and it stuck. But it is a bit misleading, or a lot misleading. A little bit hard to get your head around it, but basically there was nothing outside of the universe in this picture. So you can actually try to analyze this. So you can take a sphere and you can of space-time, and you can put mass and energy inside the thing and make it uniformly distributed and try to solve Einstein's equations with that. And you can look at it in different ways. We call them different metrics, but basically you get a set of equations, which actually this is the shorthand for Einstein's field equations, and you can ask what happens to this universe. And it turns out that general relativity is quite happy with the space-time expanding or contracting or whatever. There's no real preferred thing, and it sort of depends on the details of the universe. That is exactly how much energy and mass you have in there and with what speed things are moving. So when Einstein first looked at this, he he discovered this instability, basically, that the universe might be expanding or collapsing, and he literally put a term in the equations to stabilize it, and he called it cosmological constant. And he put it in there because of his belief that we live in a stable universe. And in his defense, scientifically, there was no evidence that anything else was true. It's because it was before it was discovered that the galaxy was only in wavelengths. But it was also sort of an example where the human bias came into play. Right? He's creating a model of our universe, and in some sense, he wants it to be stable. So one of the reasons why you want it to be stable is because, for example, if it's expanding and you go back in time, then you have a real problem. Because you get infinite densities, you effectively have a start of time. And then you're stuck with the question, well, what came before that? That's a big problem. So there was a model that was around for many years, which is called the steady-state model. And in that model, you also have an issue, which is once you discover that all the galaxies are basically moving away from each other, then in such a way that it's as if the space is expanding everywhere, you have to account for that. And one model accounts called the steady-state model. And in the steady-state model, they basically say you have material being generated everywhere in the universe and the space in between galaxies and such. And so although the space is expanding, you have new material coming into play which condenses into various things. And you basically can concoct a situation where at any given era in the universe, if you look around you, it will all look effectively the same. Okay, you may have galaxies in slightly different places or whatever, but the basic overall structure and density stays the same. So that's a different picture. It also makes very different predictions. So I then, you know, it has the advantage that you have no beginning of time and you have no end of time. It has the disadvantage that what's generating this matter that's turning into the galaxies that we see as they move away from us. Okay, so we don't know everything, but it has certain problems and certain strengths. So what I want to do right now is to go through some of the lines of evidence that lead us to actually believe that the Big Bang happened. And one of the clips I'm going to have you look at on Wednesday, my friend Lawrence Krauss will sit and tell you that we don't really talk about the Big Bang as a theory. It happened. That is how strong the evidence is for it. It is not controversial in the circles of astronomy and physics. Okay? So why? Why do we believe this? All right, one big piece of evidence that you've already seen is that as we look at the galaxies and we look farther and farther away, they are moving away from us faster. So that certainly is fit by the idea that the universe is expanding. So what does this lead to? Boy, this is not going to be easy to see. So if you imagine that the Big Bang happened and you go back in time, you should run across a bunch of phase transitions. Why? Because the energy density and the mass density in the universe changes as you go back in time. So you can imagine that we start out with effectively infinite energy densities in an infinitely small universe. How that works, I'm not going to tell you right now. I mean, we don't really know, but we're going to talk a lot about what we think may have happened sort of around here. But let us just humor me for a minute. Let's imagine this happened. And all of a sudden, whatever it is, the space itself now starts to expand. Okay? As it expands, what will happen is the energy density will drop. And as the energy density drops, you begin to get to energy densities that correspond to things that we actually understand in the physics laboratory. So you get to energy densities that correspond to the things we study in particle accelerators, for example. And once you begin to do that, we actually do understand what's going on. So we actually probe in the laboratory things that happen at pretty short times. I've forgotten the exact number. It's on the order of 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 15 seconds after the Big Bang. So it really doesn't take long before the energy density reaches a level where we understand the fundamental processes that are sort of going on. So you start out with what we call a primordial soup of high energy particles. And when I tell you, when we talk about the fact that as you go up in energy or high energy density, the nature of the forces change, then this is sort of the period that I'm talking about. So for example, one of the things that sets the weak interaction apart from the electromagnetic interaction is that in the electromagnetic interaction, the virtual particle that gets exchanged is a photon. The photon has zero mass. Because of that, effectively in the uncertainty principle, you can have a photon that has as small an energy as you can imagine, which means it can go very far, so the range of the electromagnetic force is infinite. The weak force we think of as weak because the particle that gets exchanged is extraordinarily heavy, the W and the Z. Because of that, the virtual particle, in a sense, has to give you an uncertainty in energy, which is at least at the minimum on its mass, which means the uncertainty in time is very, very short by the uncertainty principle, which means it can only go a short distance. So the weak interaction is very, very small. But if you can imagine that you are in a universe where all of the interactions and energy density is so high that the difference in mass between the photon and the W and the Z is basically non-negligible, then you will not see any difference between the weak and the electromagnetic interaction. So that's just an example of how things sort of change. Up until about... If you look inside a proton, as the quarks and the gluons get really, really close together, you have very high energy density and the force is relatively weak. The strong interaction becomes very, very strong when you don't probe to those distances, if you're about 10 to the minus 15 meters away. So we think that in the early stages, for example, we had sort of lots of subatomic particles, and in fact, we didn't have protons and neutrons. We had what's known as a quark-gluon plasma, because the energy density was so high, it was basically the same energy density we have in a proton and a neutron, and the quarks and gluons effectively move freely inside the protons and neutrons. But at 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, the universe's temperature dropped to something on the order of 10 to the 11 Kelvin. And we reached a temperature where the processes, the energy density started to be a little bit less, and the quarks and gluons condensed into protons and neutrons. So at this point, we have a universe that's basically protons and neutrons and electrons and photons and neutrinos. So that's sort of mainly what it is. And this then proceeds for a little while. As the protons and neutrons form. But there's a period here of about 3 minutes that's really important for us in this whole scenario of the Big Bang. What's happening is you have protons and neutrons, and it turns out if you have a bunch of protons and neutrons and you hit them one another, the protons can lock on to the neutrons, maybe some other protons, and you can change from protons that are hydrogen into other nuclei, like lithium, beryllium, helium, and such. So for this to really happen, these nucleons have to hit each other, and you have to have the neutrons around. There's a funny thing about free neutrons. If you make them have a lifetime in the lab, that's only... I forget, 9 minutes, 19 minutes. I mean, it's on the order of minutes, okay? So they will actually disappear. So in the early stage of the universe, you have basically half protons and half neutrons, but the neutrons are basically decaying away and effectively going to beta decay, the decaying protons and electrons and neutrinos. And so the neutrons are disappearing. So at the same time, the universe is very hot and expanding, and you have lots of collisions. So you end up with this sort of competition between the protons and neutrons glomming onto each other enough to begin to form elements, and the neutrons disappearing, and things cooling off and expanding enough that you have even fewer collisions. And this, so you can imagine having this sort of soup that you literally have hot and it's cooling off fairly quickly, and half of it is sort of decaying away. But in the meantime, that stuff that does stick together sticks around because you get these stable light nuclei. At about 3 minutes after the Big Bang, things have cooled off enough and enough of the free protons have disappeared that you stop having these collisions happening and you stop having light nuclei being formed. This period during these 3 minutes where these light nuclei are formed is something which is known as Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And I'm not talking about sulfur and oxygen and uranium and hydrogen, okay? I'm talking about the small elements, lithium, beryllium, helium, tritium, deuterium, little things. The interesting thing about this, I'll probably come back to this picture. If I plot as a function of time after the Big Bang, if I plot the fraction of the mass in the universe that is made up of different types of nuclei, almost all of it is hydrogen. So it's free protons and neutrons. Note, this is a log scale. The neutrons are decaying away here, so they're actually falling off in their fraction fairly quickly. Things cool enough that right about 3 minutes, so on the order of hundreds of seconds, you get this stage where the neutrons and protons join each other and you form light nuclei. So what you see right here are the light nuclear species increasing in fraction. So this is helium-4, this is atomic hydrogen, this is helium-3, tritium, etc. And then notice the neutrons all decay away virtually to nothing. The protons and whatever is formed at about 3 minutes then stays basically constant to today. So what you have is, if you understand the nuclear physics, you basically put your nuclear physics and the density, this soup, in a pot, and you just let it bubble for 3 minutes, and then you ask, what do you come out with? And you can do that calculation based on stuff we know and understand in laboratories today. And you can predict how much, if you go into intergalactic space, you can predict how much helium to tritium or hydrogen to beryllium-7 you should see. Okay? And it's a very clear and definite prediction that comes out of Big Bang theory. And there's nothing in steady-state universe that necessarily drives this, okay? And the cool thing is, the measurements are very hard to do because, of course, we're looking through a bunch of stars, and the stars have had fusion reactions that basically cook the gas and give you different nuclear dependencies. But there are ways in which you can infer the abundance of elements in the intergalactic medium that astronomers have done. And in fact, they find that it matches very, very well Big Bang nuclear synthesis values. Right? So it's, as a physicist would say, it is a non-trivial prediction that is borne out by the experiment. Any questions on that? Yeah.
So, trios just, that's like, they're just going to go, they're just only not being paid, is that what you're saying?
Basically, when neutrinos are formed, they're just there. They're just all over the place. They do occasionally interact with matter, but for all intents and purposes, neutrinos that were formed in the earliest stages of interactions in the earliest stages of the universe are still with us, and we are being bathed in them right now. But they're very, very low energies on average. And it turns out that the probability for an interaction, a neutrino interacting with matter, is proportional to its energy. So when you go to those low energies, we have no technology that allows us to detect them.
Is this room considered low energy? You know what I mean?
Oh, these things are all relative.
Yeah. Because I mean, we're talking about extreme.
This room is at very high energy compared to the neutrinos that I'm talking about. Yeah. Okay. So other predictions. So we have condensation into quarks, protons and neutrons. We then go through this period where we form low mass nuclei with very definite predictions of what should come out of that, which seems to be borne out by what we see. Then we have other very clear prediction that comes out of this. There's a period between this 3 minutes and about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, during which there are lots of light nuclei, there are protons and lithium nuclei and things like that, and lots of electrons and lots of photons, but they're not connected. So what we have is what we call plasma, which is a gas of charged particles. And the funny thing about a gas of charged particles is if I take a photon, if I take a beam of light, and I have a gas of charged particles, it's okay. The light will be absorbed and emitted and scattered, so that basically no image comes through. It just, if your eyeball is in it, it would seem bright, but you would not be able to image anything. It's just basically opaque. So the universe is opaque for the first 380,000 years. What happens at 380,000 years after the Big Bang is the temperature, the reason you have a plasma in here is that every time an electron approaches a nucleus and begins to bind, it gets knocked off by some photon or some other nucleus that hits it. The reason is because the universe is so hot. It's above about 3,000 degrees. If I take a gas here on Earth that's perfectly neutral and normal, like this air, and I put it in something and I heat it up to 3,000 degrees, we will not have regular atoms either. You'll have a plasma. You'll ionize all the atoms. So the early universe was so hot that neutral atoms couldn't exist. And then at 380,000-ish years after the Big Bang, the universe had cooled to the point that the electrons could begin to stick to the nuclei and form neutral atoms. And at that point, because you go from a plasma of charged particles to a gas of neutral particles, we know with a gas of neutral particles, if I have light, the light can travel through it freely. So what happens at 380,000 years after the Big Bang, you have an opaque, energetic thing that changes into a transparent thing. So all the light that was present in the universe at 380,000 years after the Big Bang, in a pretty short period of time, all of a sudden begins to stream freely through the universe. So the implications of this are huge, because what it means is that that light should fill the universe. There's nothing to stop it. It should just be traveling. Yes, occasionally a photon from this light will hit the Earth and be absorbed or something, but by and large, all that light is now free streaming. Yeah. Do you have a question?
Well, at certain
I did have a question, but I kind of left it.
All right.
So are photons not created yet? They don't sound.
No, photons are all over the place. It's just they're scattering, they're re-emitting, they're getting absorbed, they're knocking electrons off of atoms, you know, that don't exist because it's too hot. And all of a sudden it cools enough, and now the photons can travel freely.
Okay.
So that's a phase transition here, which the astrophysicists call recombination. Let's not worry about where the name comes from. But what it means is that at 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe goes from opaque to transparent. And there was light all over the place. Normally, it wasn't going very far before it was absorbed. All of a sudden, the universe becomes transparent, and whatever light is there now goes. So that light, we should be able to see. Now, it's a little subtle. Remember, we talked about black body radiation. What we have is a black body. We have an object that is glowing at a temperature of about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. I can tell you exactly what the black body spectrum is. So the light that we see from that stage of the universe, according to Big Bang Theory, should have a black body spectrum that corresponds to 3,000 degrees Kelvin at that time. It's a little bit subtle because we live in this expanding universe. So light that is traveling in an expanding universe effectively has its wavelength lengthened because the space itself is expanding, which means the frequency of the light that was around then at 3,000 degrees is really very high frequency, and you know, it'll be ultraviolet and visible light. Okay, the wavelength gets lengthened so that that very light that is emitted at 380,000 years after the Big Bang basically has a much lower frequency now because the wavelength has changed due to the expansion of space. It effectively takes the black body spectrum and shifts it down in frequency. It peaks in what we would call the microwave region of the spectrum right now. And it would correspond to a black body now that has a temperature of about 4 degrees Kelvin. Very, very cold. But nevertheless, that's what you want to go looking for. So, you will see a video clip Wednesday that where the discoverer of this light, it's actually been observed. We call it the cosmic microwave background. Microwave because the wavelength is now shifted into the microwave. Cosmic for obvious reasons. Background because it is coming at us from everywhere. So there's a very, very, very particular prediction from the Big Bang Theory that this light should be coming to us from everywhere. Its distribution in frequency and intensity all is pretty clearly predicted. Again, the steady state theory has nothing of the sort. Okay, so then you have that prediction. Light should be coming to us from about 380,000 light years after the Big Bang, or years after the Big Bang. You should also have regions of this, and there's nothing obvious in the Big Bang Theory that gives you this. You should have regions of this early universe where you have higher and lower densities. The reason we know you have to have that is because the way it works is we have this big universe filled with hydrogen, and if I have regions which are slightly more dense than others, those are the regions that gravity will begin to collapse into galactic clusters and galaxies. And we know that the universe isn't perfectly uniform because we have dogs and planets and stars and galactic clusters. So we know that there has to be some sort of structure on the cosmic microwave background. And we even have some idea of what the size needs to be, because the picture is that these asymmetries then lead into the condensation into regions where you then get stars born, and you have stellar formation, you have supernovas that give you remember, through the fusion processes and supernovas, you can get the heavy elements, and eventually you reach the point where you can have things like rocky growth and such. So that's basically the picture. This is highly nonlinear. This is at a microsecond. This is at 380,000 years, and this is today. So that's just 13.8 billion years after this thought. So that's the basic picture. It has some very basic predictions. We call it the cosmic microwave background, and in fact, I want to come back to that. It was discovered in 1964. You'll again hear the story on Wednesday. It's actually sort of a fun story. It was discovered by a couple of astronomers who were trying to do something completely different, and basically they kept getting the signal that manifests itself as noise, like a buzz in their microwave detector, because they were wanting to look at microwave frequencies to study some stars. And they couldn't get rid of it, no matter how they pointed it, no matter how they cleaned their thing. They had a real problem. And eventually, they connected with a group at Princeton who were actually in the midst of building a detector to go looking for this cosmic microwave background. So it turns out that no matter what direction you look, we do see light coming at us that has exactly a black body spectrum that corresponds to a black body spectrum of, it's about 2.7 degree black body. So, and this agrees exactly with what you would expect out of the Big Bang. So that led to a Nobel Prize for these guys, Penzias and Wilson, in 1964. And this really was the piece of evidence that made people take the Big Bang idea really seriously. I mean, you have the expanding universe, and that's certainly one thing. But this is something that you really, there's no other way to generate that people had thought of. So that's a huge piece of evidence in favor of the Big Bang. I mentioned Big Bang nucleosynthesis. I'm going to come back to this, but let me just paint the picture right now for the moment. The light that's hitting us now was emitted 13.7 some billion years ago. It's coming to us from all over. Remember, it was emitted about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, which means if you were to center a piece of the universe around us and ask what was our observable universe at that moment, it would have a size of 400,000 light years. The light that is reaching us now from the Big Bang is coming from much farther away than that. That is, the light that we see now is coming from a piece of the universe that was not observable to us at the time it was emitted. Okay? And in terms of the amount of time that had passed, the observable universe for the piece of the universe that emitted the light that we now see at 400,000 years after the start of the Big Bang was only about this big. It was about this size. Similarly, over here. So what that means is that the light that was emitted from here and the light that was emitted from here had never been in causal contact. The universe, the piece of the universe that emitted the light that we see in this direction, cosmic microwave background, and the piece of the universe that emitted light from that direction, cosmic microwave background, those pieces of the universe in the Big Bang model had never been in causal contact before. And we're seeing them. And one of the biggest problems with the Big Bang, which we'll be coming back to, is that the cosmic microwave background temperature and spectrum over here looks exactly like that over here. And if it had never been in causal contact, how in the world can that be? So there's a I'm going to spend the better part of the lecture talking about the problems with the Big Bang, but right now I don't want to get too much into that. I want to make you believers first. All right. Boy, do I want to do this right now? Let me summarize. We believe in the Big Bang because we have very strong evidence of the expanding space. And the expansion is such as if the space itself is expanding, so things you remember times. When we look at the abundance of light nuclei in intergalactic space, it fits exactly what you would expect from the phase transition picture of the Big Bang. Again, with this phase transition picture of the Big Bang, you expect the early universe to have been a 3,000 degree black body when it goes from being an opaque thing into a transparent thing, and that light should have been basically traveling since that time. And that makes a very specific prediction for light that we should see that should basically be uniform and coming at us from all directions, and should have a black body spectrum, should peak at a certain value, and we see it. Okay? The last thing is, if you have a way of producing small asymmetries in the universe at an early stage, that should turn into regions of higher density and basically condense into the galaxies and stars and things that we see. There's a bit of an if there, because in and of itself, with the Big Bang, I do not have that mechanism. But nevertheless, in principle, it could be there, so it's sort of a supporting idea. However, there's a piece that I haven't yet talked about, which is, do we see asymmetries in do we see structure or fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background? Because, if I have asymmetries in the early part of the universe that eventually lead to the energy and matter asymmetries that condense into the galactic clusters and things that we see, I should see those asymmetries in the light that was emitted 380,000 years after the Big Bang. That is, there should be certain regions that should look hotter than others. Okay, and we're going to look at those pictures. In fact, we do see that, and that's another huge reason to believe in the Big Bang. All right, so I'm going to come back to the Big Bang, but we now have sort of this basic picture of an evolving universe. And since this is called Visions of the Multiverse, I'm going to take this opportunity to just tell you about one of the sort of wackier multiverses that's out there. This one actually is unique insofar as I know, is that it is falsifiable. So where you might argue that all the multiverses we look at are not scientific because they are not falsifiable, this one is. It's called the Feakin Multiverse, and there's a guy named Lee Smolin who actually works at something called the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Canada, near Toronto. And he's written a book called The Life of the Cosmos where he proposes this. And he asks the question, he wonders, you know, what happens inside a black hole? And that's a bit of an odd question. Well, you wonder. It's almost mute in the sense that as things fall into a black hole, the gravitational field is such that it's so strong that even light can't escape. So as things go into a black hole, we become causally disconnected from what happens inside that black hole. Right? You cannot send a signal out. From our point of view, with general relativity, the clock of a thing going in slows down to the point where it stops at what's known as the event horizon, which is this region from which light can no longer escape. So a black hole is causally disconnected from us. But that doesn't keep people from wondering what happens if you go in. If you were able to keep from being ripped apart from the black hole, and you fell into the black hole, remember it's all this whole clock slowing down thing from special relativity, it's very much just a picture of your perspective, right? So from your perspective, as you fall into the black hole, your clock is fine, okay? It's people out here would see your time having stopped, and you'd never actually go into the black hole, but you wouldn't notice. At any rate, so if you imagine material going into the black hole, there's nothing to stop it. So it basically collapses down. The idea is in the middle of this black hole, you have what's called a singularity, which is if you have put higher and higher mass density there, basically the equations of physics go crazy. We can't understand what's going on. So one of the things Lee works on is an area of what's called quantum gravity, that is, what happens when you get to those kinds of crazy densities and stuff. And so he doesn't have a theory that really, I would say, we don't have a working theory of quantum gravity, and he sort of takes advantage of the fact that, you know, we don't really know what would happen. And he sort of throws out this crazy idea. He says, well, suppose that the space-time when the black holes form basically collapses and it reaches a very high energy density and then effectively rebounds. Okay? And in the rebound, he argues that the characteristics of the space-time, you may undergo some quantum fluctuations, but whatever physical constants and everything you had in this outside universe should largely be preserved as it rebounds. But you may have some quantum effects that happen which will change some of the fundamental ways in which the space-time is tied together and give you some change in physical constants. So he basically has this idea that inside a black hole, you have space-time collapsing, you effectively get a quantum gravity bounce, and then you have this expanding space-time. And you can concoct this expanding space-time such that if you were in the midst of it, you would, it would look just like a Big Bang that was us. So in this crazy picture, you effectively have universes being born within black holes. Okay? Now, this leads to something sort of fun. It is a multiverse theory in the sense that we have a causally disconnected universe being born within a black hole. So I'm about out of time, but just bear with me for one second. So if you can imagine what this is, we could have physical constants in our universe such that black holes don't form. So, for example, if the gravitational force was much stronger or much weaker, if the strong nuclear force is very different, then stellar processing wouldn't happen in such a way that we actually get black holes to form. So what he argues is if you lived in a multiverse where you have within the black holes universes being formed, and if the physical characteristics of the universe are changing a little bit each time you have one being formed, then if you were able to step outside and look at the whole multitude of universes, here's our universe, we form a black hole which forms a universe inside it. And if it is a universe that has physical constants so that it's very likely to form black holes, it will form lots of universes. If it is one where the physical constants are such that you aren't likely to form black holes, you won't form any other universes. So in this picture, it says that of all the universes that are formed, you are very likely to be in one where it is likely that you would have a black hole. And that actually places constraints on the physical constants that you would expect to see in our universe. So if you go and you look at our universe and you see that the physical constants are not optimal for black hole production, then you falsified this crazy multiverse idea. So it's the one scientific multiverse theory that's out there. So is that true or not? Well, I've read quotes from astronomers where some of them say, yeah, it sort of seems to be that we're fairly optimal, and I have others that say, well, not at all. So it's currently an argument. We may never be able to resolve it, but in principle, we can. Anyway, so it's a sort of a wacky multiverse idea. But who knows, with all these multiverse ideas, how wacky it is, we may never know. But I'm out of time, so I have to stop here. Less and less dense as well, so I guess it is true that you have more room, but
I just thought it would be interesting to not have to, you know, try to get people to be to believe in the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
To not even have to do that when you could just point out that it kind of fits the Big Bang. There was formless. Let there be light.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're talking about, so you're talking about the earth was formless. It doesn't mean, how can the earth be formless? It means it hasn't been formed yet. The stuff,
mm-hmm.
the earth is being made out. It's really not that hard, you know?
No, I think people who are want to take the scripture seriously, you know,
right.
That's not lost on them. One of the things that has been a thorn of contention is that the time frames are very different.
So, right.
You know, there's this idea that it should have happened, you know, 6,000 years ago-ish, something like
right,
that.
Right, but when time
and
is relative, what the heck
with the
does that mean?
But, you know, I've heard people, you know, talk about, well, you know, what does God mean by day, right? I mean, so there's wiggle room there.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like there needs to be, because it really is, I think... During this class, it's gotten, like, you know, out there in the world, the lines have gotten a little deeper drawn for some reason. Like, the debate seems to be kind of picking up out there right now.
I think that the debate has always been there.
Yeah, I know, but I mean recently, like, maybe because I'm watching it, but it seems like it's coming up again during this class.
It's certainly there.
Yeah.
And